We'll sit first. Is that amplified? Yeah. Today's parami is sila. One way we could translate that would be the discipline and virtue of awakening. So as you sit, what's the disposition of awareness? What's the mode of engagement? And how do they translate into what exactly you are engaging? How do you engage your body that makes it available for awareness? How do you engage your breath? That lets it manifest, allowing and releasing. How do you engage consciousness that supports it to be awake and aware rather than swirling around in all the thoughts and feelings? Did anyone let you know they weren't coming, Gil? No.
Okay.
What?
Kristen. Did you just say, did anyone let you know they weren't coming?
Yes, that's what I said. Yeah.
And Conrad also.
Conrad said he's not coming.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and Casey as well.
Oh. And Jennifer's coming, as far as you know?
She usually comes late.
Yeah.
But so on Slack, I've been away for a week, so I haven't been on Slack. I don't know. So that's all of us, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Did you say Jennifer is not coming?
She's coming.
No, she is coming. But sometimes she travels the whole way down from Santa Rosa, so it takes a while to get through all the traffic. So let's start by going around and saying our names. And if you would, say the pronouns you prefer. Would you like to start, Kay?
Kay, she, her.
I am Sage. I use she, her pronouns.
Barbara, she, her.
Elisa, they, them, please.
Letisa, she, her.
Sharon, she, her.
Sri, he, his.
Clarence, he, him.
Alan, he, him.
AJ, she, her.
Alan, he, him.
Gil, he, him. How'd I do?
And Paul, he, him. Thank you. So as I was saying, today's parami is sila. Yeah. And the word sila includes the admonition of early Buddhism and then later Buddhism too. Don't harm, do good. And then in early Buddhism, purify the mind. And then in later Buddhism, include everything. And so usually the don't harming is expressed by refraining from or abstaining from certain conduct. And then the do good is expressed by virtuous conduct, you know, and that includes everything from the virtue of practicing awareness and mindfulness to metta, loving kindness towards others, and then behaving in a way that's beneficial for others. And then purifying the mind, that as we take up the first two, the abstaining and the encouraging of certain behaviors, they help the mind to settle. They help our conduct to be more congruent with our virtuous intentions. And that, as the mind settles, the mind and our whole sensibility of being, we become more, less conflicted, less distracted, less out of touch with what we are. The different parts of us become more integrated. And what we're intending and what we're doing have a resonance. And then including others. In some ways we could say, well, attending to the mind is attending to the internal process. And then including others is attending to the interpersonal process. You know, that a lot of our life is contextual. It's interpersonal. And so, and then when you look at the arc of how Buddhist practice has evolved and how it has codified, you know, and how, where it has principles and where it has codes of conduct, you can see this simple notion. Simple intellectually, not so simple to do. don't harm, do good, and take it into your life and let it be part of who you are and how you are. In early Buddhism, especially for monks and nuns, there were elaborate codes of conduct. Yeah. 256 rules for monks and 350 for nuns. I won't comment on the different numbers. Maybe we'll kill Will. And then the interesting question for us is, how does that apply to chaplaincy? Yeah. And one way is that chaplaincy happens in a context. It's an interpersonal activity. And the other part of it is, how do you discipline yourself to be of service to others? You know, the very notion, the intention of being of service is its own kind of, has its own sila. You know? Like, then you have to take that intention and you have to contextualize it. Okay, I'm going to do my chaplaincy in this environment, with homeless people, in a prison, in a hospital, you know, or however you're doing it. Yeah. And then we can ask ourselves, well, what does that ask of me? What does that ask of me in terms of the refraining? And what does that ask of me in terms of coming forward and acting in a way that's of benefit for others? Yeah. And then each place we enter into, it has a context. I remember going to a prison once, and the person saying, the guard who was, you know, signing me in, angrily pointing at me and saying, "You're wearing a white shirt," you know, and I had no idea that that was inappropriate in that context. So in a way, there's an educational component to it. Yeah. And I think it behooves us, rather than just think, well, that's weird, you know, why? What's the problem with a white shirt? You know, to think about, as I once heard a warden say, he said, "We're always thinking of security and safety." Yeah. Like when you say we want to bring in some cushions, we're thinking, does that influence the security? You know, you may or may not know that in prisons you do not exchange objects with the inmates. When you do a meditation group, some prisons insist upon having a prison guard in the room. No. There is a code of conduct. And and similarly with hospitals, and maybe more so with hospitals, there are all sorts of, you know, the privacy of the patient, you know, the liability of the hospital, the protocols they have for certain illnesses, and if you're going to function as a chaplain in those places, you're obliged to pay attention and uphold those codes of conduct. And then for us as practitioners of Buddhism, you know, there is like another code of conduct and another set of ethics, you know, that arise from our practice, you know. And, you know, you could say the five prohibitory precepts are a code of conduct, or the 10 grave precepts. And then you could say that in this course, as we go through the paramis and we discuss certain points of practice and how they apply to chaplaincy, that we're cultivating a code of conduct. And code of conduct can have two significant aspects to it. One, you might say, would be the ethical principles, you know, the sensibilities that from which we extract or we express the particulars. So we have the sensibility of practice. Uh-huh. Look at some of the things we promote are being present with someone, deeply listening to what they have to say, you know, not being judgmental, not assuming you know how they should think or feel or behave about anything. Yeah, that's our code of conduct. And then we contextualize it. When we go into an institution, we blend these two codes of conduct. The ones we cultivate from our practice, and then the ones of the institution. And then that in that blending them together, we look for a resonance, you know? Like, and maybe sometimes we find there isn't a resonance, you know? I remember once when I was running a meditation group in a prison, one of the guards said to me, he said, "I resent you coming here." And I said, "Oh, why?" And he said, "You're making their life easier. You're making them suffer less. They're here to suffer. This is a punishment." And I thought, oh, how interesting, you know? This very basic premise of practice, which is like to alleviate suffering. And then to have someone tell me, no, we're trying to increase their suffering. You know, honestly, at that point in that exchange, I didn't say anything. But okay, yeah, that's your position, and that's not mine. I refrained from furthering the conversation. Yeah. Like, to my mind, I was upholding the principles of a chaplain coming to be of benefit, and at the same time, not antagonizing someone else because they have a different code of conduct. And so part of what we'll explore today, the different ways, the sila, you know, the refraining, the promoting of the virtuous, and contextualizing them both, We'll look at that at the different applications within chaplaincy. Okay, thank you.
Okay, is this loud enough? If I speak louder, can we turn it down? And maybe it's a little bit better? Or just this perfect? Or, because I'm speaking louder than I normally would. Is this perfect? Okay, this is good? Last week I thought, I think it's time for me to learn the skill of speaking louder. After all these decades, I think I'm going quieter and quieter. And what happens to me when I speak louder, it doesn't feel right to me because I haven't done it very much. Sometimes I sound like I'm being angry. And so that's one of the reasons. And also, I don't think the same way. I think when I talk quieter, I'm thinking closer to, you know, my meditation, the Dharma. When I speak louder, I think I'm a little bit distracted from myself almost. But that's just because of maybe habit. And I was like this week, I was wondering, maybe I should try to learn a new skill. So this is the first kind of chance to do it, so a little bit. So we'll see how it goes. And if you think that I respond to you angrily, angrily, ask if that's the case. Just, you know, don't assume, or because is it okay with you all that I do that? So I apologize if this doesn't work. So we are following sila, ethics in the paramis after generosity. And I think this is really important. For me, it's very central. Because one of the questions we can ask is, what's the source of our ethics? Paul did a beautiful job talking about the care of self and others in being ethical. But where's the source? Where does it come from? And not a few people, their ethics comes from obligation, comes from a sense of duty. Like you're supposed to, you should. It's a requirement, and there's another possibility, and that is that ethics comes from generosity. We want to benefit people. We want to do good for people. We out of our generosity, we're giving something to people. In the early Buddhist tradition, they talk about when you're being ethical, you're giving people safety. In one of the most recent retreats I taught, the three-week retreat in September, there was a woman who said this was the safest. She said, this is the first time I've ever in my life felt safe in a group of people. Not growing up, not in her family, not in her culture, her society. It's phenomenal that people who don't feel safe in our society. It's kind of, you can kind of say, call it an epidemic of fear or at lack of safety. So just to hear that and to know that there are such things, might that generate the generosity, the wish to give people safety? How do we do that? We can't necessarily go out there and fix the world. Paul's not going to go to the prison and sit down the prison guard and have a nice heart-to-heart talk with them and say, you know, this punishment thing is maybe a little bit overrated. But Paul can go into the prison, and the prisoners can feel he is safe. He's bringing safety. He's maybe the first person in a week or a month or a year or the whole sentence that they felt that they didn't have to be afraid of. phenomenal. So we can bring that, and the ethics of being a chaplain is partly so that we can provide someone with a phenomenal gift, as opposed to being someone who is only there not to harm, which is a little bit how sometimes the ethics and precepts are put up. We don't want to harm, we don't want to do this or that because we're going to harm people, and you have to be really careful with this and that. And sometimes it's like chaplains shouldn't touch people physically, and that's a whole question about how much you can touch. Jennifer sometimes says, nothing above the elbow. And so and even that maybe is too much. Maybe you have permission to hold a hand. So touch can have, you know, you can cause a lot of harm in touching. That's what, so you can tiptoe around like that, or you can turn it around and say, what's the generous thing to do here to help people feel safe? I become a safer person if I don't, without asking, touch them. The generosity is holding back and not rushing in. And it's the same behavior, but it's coming from a different place inside. And I think it works a lot better for us to come from a place of generosity than coming from a place of restraint. Restraint is very important. It's a phenomenally great, wonderful practice. I don't want to kind of diminish its role. But we have the opportunity when we live an ethical life to come. Where's the source? Where's it coming from inside of us? And when the possibility is to come from compassion, possibility is to come from generosity, possibility coming from love, kindness, friendliness, it has a very different impact on you than if it comes from from restraint, tiptoeing around, walking on eggshells, biting your tongue, afraid of what you're going to say and do, and you have to be just perfect and right in all kinds of ways. That can be draining. In a sense, you know, don't do harm that Paul evoked earlier. It's easy to do harm to oneself in living an ethical life. If the source, the motivation for it, the context in which we bring it forth into the world is one that contracts us or diminishes us or squashes something inside of us. If we come from generosity, and maybe it's exactly the same behavior, so we're just as safe and just as people are just as protected from us, but if we come from generosity, there's something that opens in us. There's something that flows and comes out of us. And goodness, more generosity. Generosity begets generosity. Compassion, well done. Compassion which is generous produces more compassion. Compassion which is an obligation, I don't think it produces more compassion. I don't think it generates more compassion. What is it that generates? What's the generative possibility of what we do? So there's the source from which things come. And what is generated when things come? There's a wonderful term in the Pali Canon in Theravada Buddhism called yoniso manisikara. And you know Sanskrit a little bit? How would you try? You know that word? I think it's almost the same in Sanskrit. Yoniso manisikara. Manisikara? You don't have to know it. Manisikara is the heart? Wow, fantastic. I was hoping something wonderful like that. Because what happens in these wonderful Buddhist terms that the Buddhists have, we kind of narrow its meaning. Whereas in India, you go to India, and you hear that these words are so rich. Recently, I told someone about this, you know, how we translate a word into English, and the Indian man said, it lost all its richness. So you said heart. So manisikara is often translated as something like your thinking, how you think. And how you go from how you're thinking to what's your heart is like, you know, kind of interesting.
But Yoni So is Yoni. You know Yoni?
Not Yoni.
No, Yoni. So Yoni, in Pali at least, can mean womb. So the womb that, and so sometimes it's called wise reflection, wise thinking. But it comes from womb. So what can we generate from that, using that metaphor? And so I've been thinking lately about gestating action, gestating intention, engagement, gestating heartfulness, how we do. So generating, gestating. What are we gestating? What are we generating? And so if we act from generosity, that is generous, not generosity which is obligatory, then it's not generosity, then something is being generated, gestating, something's cooking in there. Generosity, which is generous, produces more. Compassion, which is generous, produces more of both. Friendliness, that is non-obligatory, friendliness, which is you know, heartfelt and generous, produces more friendliness, both in ourselves and sometimes in others. If people feel that we're coming from obligation and duty, some people might feel that's right, you're supposed to be that way. But I don't think that's generative or gestating goodness in yourself or the person who's oriented in life that way. The prison guard who Paul goes in there and says, okay, well, I guess, you know, I'll follow suit and punish. I'll just give them, I'll put them in full lotus when we meditate and for 40 minutes. and then the guard says, good, he got the obligation. He understands his duty. That's good, you know. That guard doesn't, what's that generating? What's arising from that in the guard? So this the world of generosity I'd like to propose to you is a really rich world that has this kind of hourglass kind of shape. The bottom of the hourglass, or maybe it's the top of the hourglass where the sand comes from, is really wide, the source inside of us. If it doesn't narrow it by obligation and duty and should, but if it comes from our goodness, from heartfeltness, from this huge kind of place of having released the contractions of the heart, the limitations of the heart, release the limitations of our thinking that puts things into boxes and shoulds and things. Generosity is a beautiful thing. And then the bottom of it, where all the sand goes, I guess, is what's generated, the goodness that can arise from it. And what's in the middle, the hourglass, is right now, this moment. What are we receiving from in this moment? And what are we generating out of this moment as we come? And when we think this way, sometimes the literal success of what we're trying to do is not so important. Meaning that if someone feels that, you know, that there's a tremendous generosity in our what we're doing, but the act that we did didn't quite work. Oh, you're hungry. Let me go in the kitchen. I would love to do something for you, and I'll bring you an apple. I think I have an apple for you. And just wait a minute, but you know, it's going to be a little bit of work for me because I broke my leg and I have to kind of, you know, a little bit take me the while to hobble in there and ouching all the way. But I'm going to get you the apple. And they come in, you bring out the apple and you give it to them and they're thankful and then they go away and they take a bite. It's completely rotten. The effort to feed them failed. But maybe they've never experienced that level of generosity from anyone who cared, who went to the trouble to help them. And the generative possibility of that act of generosity maybe is greater than any benefit they would have gotten from eating the apple. So in chaplaincy, I suggest that exploring this parami of generosity in how it brings forth ethics, how it brings forth the conduct, the contextualization, the care for others, understanding how we're going to behave and act and help make the situation safer for everyone, so that we feel happy, we're delighted, we smile. When we hear the word ethics, it is not like, oh ethics, not again. The greatest amount of anger that I ever saw generated at San Francisco Zen Center by almost like a kind of community-wide was disagreements about a code of ethics, having one. They needed to have a code of ethics before they...
before they talked about a code of ethics.
Yeah. Or they needed to recontextualize what ethics is so that they didn't feel like it was just a bunch of rules. Ethics is a beautiful expression of the yoniso manisikara, the manisikara, the heart, the generative gestating heart that we have that can bring forth beauty and wondrous and health for everyone. And so the question is, how is it that ethics can do this? What's the nature of ethics that it has this wonderful source and wonderful generative capacity? So that's my little thought. And so strange to speak about it loudly, but I'll learn. You're my pioneers. So so how about an exercise? Pair up with some. How many? 2, 4, 6, 8. I see. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Is it 12? Did I count? I don't know how to count anymore. 11. So I think if we do pairs in one group of three. And let's do this as a repeating question, so that all the different possibilities that live in you can come forth. The assumption behind this, if you're willing to go along with the assumption, is that you are a phenomenally multifaceted being with many different sides and aspects and in different situations. And so you're not just like, you know, boom, I'm just this person. And you're like male, contextually many, many kinds of people. And so the question, that's why doing a repeating question starts drawing out all these different sides. And the repeating question is, what's the source of your ethics? And kind of what we want, I'm hoping for you, is for you, the obvious things come out first. And as you keep doing it, the things that are not so obvious start bubbling up. Some of the things maybe that are not necessarily wondrous and beautiful have a chance finally to be seen and be spoken. And this is a situation where there's a lot of acceptance and allowance and welcoming of all of who you are. Whatever comes up is fine in this context. And there might be a surprise by the wondrous things that are in there that you didn't realize because you had a whole different orientation than you know what could come up if you keep doing it and doing it. So what's the source of your ethics? Is that a question? Is that okay? So maybe because the spirit of it all is safety, and this can be a little bit of a very personal, and maybe you don't feel quite ready to share with just about anybody, you have a lot of permission, if it works here, to go find someone that you feel safe with, and safety is not an issue, just maybe whatever, but just let's sort it out, and I'll help or something, but there's a lot of permission to let's sort it out so everyone feels like they're comfortable in the group. Yes?
Just one quick logistical question. Are we asking the question over and over to one person and then switch, or just back and forth?
Yeah, so you'll do it, let's see, I think what we'll do is we'll do this for 15 minutes once we start, and then you'll have 5 minutes or 6 minutes. Let's say 6 minutes for each one, and that'll give you 3 minutes or 4 minutes at the end to just debrief with each other how it went. Is that okay? And there's one group of three will have to do less than 6 minutes. If you do maybe 4 minutes each. The way that I was taught these repeating questions exercises was a person who taught us or was doing it in the groups wanted them to be 15 minutes long. So really stretched into new territory. But we don't really have the time here, but you might want to try that sometime. And if you like this exercise, you might do it with your buddy later or with your small group and maybe do the full 15 minutes and see how that goes. But for now. So just one person and then switch. Is it, okay? So why don't you find someone to either pair up with or a group of three. Hopefully that'll work. And let's see what happens. If we need to rearrange them, just if you don't feel, if you want to be more comfortable with someone else, it's completely fine. Let's try to figure it out. I want to make everyone to feel for this topic.
Yeah.
So, is someone still there? We're all back, right? Oh, yes, that's right. That's right. Well, it's okay. We're just starting informally. I just want to check in and see. Was there any insight to use intentionally, supposedly vague word? Any insight from that exercise? Anything useful about it?
Used to drive my mom crazy because I'd have to pick out a certain mug and a plate and everything, depending on the mood. I realized in talking to Elisa that, I'm not as evolved as I thought I was, and that I still have a lot of shoulds, I had a lot growing up. My parents were quite religious, but my dad really seemed to be very naturally generous and kind and giving. And my mom, on the other hand, had the self-righteous martyr syndrome going on. And I think I inherited some of both and unfortunately haven't let go of as many shoulds as I thought until we talked.
Yeah, well, what a great insight to see this in yourself.
Voila. Is the blue one okay?
Yeah, the blue one. I would have chosen the blue one, too. I thought it was interesting because I heard the question, and it was transparent to me. I just thought I knew what the question was. And then in talking, I realized maybe I didn't know what the question was. But to me, it was a question of what is the source of your ethics, like where do you even come up with where does the structure before the content come from? And so I was looking at, like, what's kind of pre-shoulds, you know, or pre-ideal behaviors. And I felt like in exploring that, I just was looking at a lot of different structures that imposed themselves on my brain. So at first I came up with all the things that I, like, the, it came from what wasn't what I was observing. Like, you know, it was a, more of a negative determination, the negative space around the code of ethics that I didn't like. It came from whatever was in the negative space in different instances. And then I started thinking, because the question was repeated and it was wonderful to have to keep, you know, pushing that envelope, that I started thinking of things like music, like a structure that plops onto your brain and organizes it, or syntax, language. Like, it's before you come up with the words that fill the content of the concept of ethics. So it was really interesting, because I never would have gotten there.
Fantastic.
Without having to keep answering the question.
Fantastic. It seems very rich, all of that. Maybe we have time for one or two more.
Yeah, we had a very good exchange in our group about ethics. I think what I've understood from my peers here is that the ethics the source of your ethics, it's very, very diverse, and the influence on the ethics could be from, you know, from family, friends, extended family, the community you live in, and the type of books you read, and what you observe, the actions from the leaders, as well as what you inculcate in the process. So. And at least my personal experience is ethics evolve. It's not a fixed thing. It is very, it's something which we can learn and grow, as opposed to a static thing. You're set for life, kind of thing. So it was a fairly rich exchange in that process. Yeah. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you. Maybe one more?
I'll add a little bit.
Yeah.
Thank you. A lot, I guess I just want to bring in conditioning, because I felt like there was so much that the three of us talked about that we observed from our communities and the people raising us and our families and what. Then I want to suggest one of my big ones was actually trial and error. You know, I would try things out. And another way I learned about ethics was really about pain and hurt, and then finally I'll just say that becoming a parent was an extraordinary lesson in ethics, because I only have one child, but they observe us all the time, and we have a lot of responsibility. So I think that's all I want to say about it. Anybody want the blue?
So to end this little section, the topic of the source of ethics in us, and as AJ said, was, you know, also going back deeper and deeper into where the source is, we get a sense that ethics is connected to some deep place in our hearts, in our identity, in our place in this world. It's a very deep thing. And when we start getting a sense of that, then the act of generosity, the act of caring, compassion for others, is we start appreciating that ethical behavior is something that for others is touching some, you know, directly or indirectly, something very deep in them. It's not simply, you know, I'm not going to steal from them. It's, I'm not going to steal from them, because that's going to touch that place where they trust or don't trust being and being alive. And I want them to be able to trust this life that they're living in. That's why I don't want to steal. I mean, there's other reasons not to steal, but you get a sense you're touching something really deep. And to live aware of the depth of people's lives, the hearts of people, and caring for that, I think, and then caring for that out of generosity or generous care, or caring generosity, then it's generative. And then it's the gestating of something wonderful for our world that wouldn't be possible if we don't steal pencils from work or something, just because. Yeah, I'm not going to steal because if they find out, then I'll get fired. That doesn't gestate much of anything interesting. And then to repeat something I said, that I want to emphasize is that the reframing of ethics in the context of generosity or care or generous compassion in something that is generating of something wonderful and rich and valuable for us might give birth to the same behavior that avoidant ethics or restraining ethics might do. But so it doesn't look any different from outside, but the inside makes a huge world of difference. And as chaplains, we're caring for that inside in ourselves and in others. So this reframing is really important for chaplaincy and chaplaincy training. Okay? So we'll come back in 15 minutes, it's 10:45, and for some reason Jennifer doesn't arrive, then we'll do something anyway. Thank you.